Hi, how are you doing today?
I'm doing very well. Nice to meet you.
Oh, it's nice to meet you. I want you to introduce yourself. You can tell my audience anything you want to tell them.
Okay, sure. Well, let's see. I'm 61 years old, and over my course of my life, I've been many things. I've been a father, a husband. I had three brothers and a sister, and I did 25 years in the Army, including 1 year in Afghanistan. After the Army, I have worked as a project manager for the Air Force. And after that, I also took a little bit of time, a semester, actually teaching mathematics to junior high school students at a small little Catholic school in Massachusetts. And most recently, within the last couple of years, I've been the author of a brand new book series called Old Grandmother's Tree.
What inspired you to write Old Grandmother's Tree? Like, how did you get started writing that?
Well, there were several things. One is, first I'd tell you a little bit about the book and I'll help you understand why I wrote it. So what it is, it's a retelling of my Quebec and Algonquin ancestors in Quebec, their lives, but retelling it in the structure and the language of a folktale. So I've retold their story inside a reimagined Quebec with magic, folktale elements, and trickster animal characters from Native American folktales. And so what inspired me more than anything, I think, was just the stories of my ancestors, and in particular, one ancestor, a young Algonquin woman named Mitiogoku. And she lived in the 1600s, second half of the 17th century, in Quebec and Trois-Rivières. And her life turns out to be very well documented by the Jesuits of that time, and how she overcame tragedy when she was a young woman. And at the end of her life, the priest in Trois-Rivières, writing about her, said that Mitiogoku lived a full life with dignity, respect, and love, a courageous and loving Algonquin woman. And I thought, what a very powerful eulogy in just two lines. And for any of us, we would be so fortunate to have our lives described in that same way, that we lived a life of dignity, respect, courage, and love. And so why is that really significant? Well, what was that tragedy that affected her life? Well, when she was 22 years old, she was married to another Algonquin man named Assabavish, and they had two small children, a boy and a girl. And Mohawk raiders up from New York came up into Quebec, Trois-Rivières, raided the village that she was living in, and her husband was killed in the attack, and her two children were kidnapped, and she never saw them again. And in fact, she never had any kind of resolution about what happened to them. They just kind of disappeared. So here she is at 22. Lost her husband, lost her two children. And, at that young age and that point in your life, when you lose everything, how do you lift yourself up for something like that? Well, she married a French settler 5 years later named Pierre Calque, and they became my ancestors. And so she had to really have overcome that, because at the end of her life, for that priest to write those wonderful things about her. And when you think how unusual it is for something like that, for something to be written about a woman back in that time period in 1699, and much less a First Nations woman. So that was kind of the inspiration. So I took her story and I reimagined it, and I told the story about how she married Pierre Calque, and how she overcame that tragedy early on when she was in her life. But I retold it with magic, folk tales, and trickster animal characters. So the book series right now, there's two books. There's 10 stories within the two books, and they're all interrelated. And 40,000 words. These are not small books. And there's 450 full color illustrations that were done by a Toronto-based artist named Natasha Pelly-Smith. And you can see some of the illustrations behind me, just a small portion of them.
Where, like, when you started writing the books, were there anything that surprised you by starting them? Like, I know you know your ancestor. Did you have to research more into her whenever you started writing the books?
Well, a lot of the research was actually done by another descendant of hers named Norman LaValle. And, as I researched my own family history, how did I find her, first of all? Okay. So growing up, I was always told my mother's family was French Canadian. We all knew that. And but I didn't know a lot about the family history. We always told we're 100% French. So anyway, I gave a DNA test to my mother and her siblings. And turns out that we're mostly French, but we also had Native American ancestry. And once I discovered that, it took about 2 years for me to find her and a couple other Native American gateway ancestors, I would call them. And it just turned out that her life was just very well documented. So the Jesuit priests in Troyer here recorded a lot of data about her life, the birth of her children, when she married Pierre Cauque, who were the godparents of her children. Where they lived in their married life. So a lot of the facts were there. And then, like I said, the very short eulogy written by Mitiu, by the priest up in Trois-Rivières.
Did you ever figure out, like, did, when in your research, was there ever any documentation to whatever happened to her other two kids that were ta that were kidnapped? Do you have any, did you ever find out anything on that?
No, we never knew. No one ever knew what happened to them. We assume that they were taken down into New York near Canajoharie. There was a Mohawk village out there. In fact, the children were taken in the same raid as the mother of Saint Kateri, a Catholic saint. So most people think of Saint Kateri as a Mohawk saint, and she was. She grew up. She was born in the Mohawk village, in the Mohawk community. And her father was Mohawk, but her mother was Algonquin, very much like Mitiogoku. And her mother was taken in the same raid as her two children. And we never knew what happened. We just assumed that they probably were, if they grew up, they survived into adulthood, they married into the Mohawk community and kind of disappeared and were assimilated. Because they probably were only about maybe 3 or 4 years old at the time that they were taken. They were very young.
So they probably wouldn't have even remembered when they might have when they've gotten older, but they probably wouldn't even remembered. I get what you're saying about that. What are some of your favorite characters from your book? Like, do you have some that are like your favorite characters?
Well, probably the most the character I like the most is Uncle Makish. Uncle Makish is a very ancient being. He was created right there at the creation of the world, along with his fellow trickster animal characters. And he kind of, to me, he represents as a character, he's vulnerable in some ways, but other ways he's very wise and very ancient. But he's vulnerable because he's very small. He's just a little turtle. He doesn't have a lot of magical powers with him at all. But he's also very wise, and sometimes he feels a little insecure about himself. And there's a chapter in the books where him and his nephew, Poku the Moose, are walking back home after an adventure in the village with the people and the humans. And they're walking back home to Mount Orford in Quebec, and they're having a conversation. And in that, Uncle Makish was talking about, well, I wasn't very successful in all the things that I did today. I wasn't able to throw the axe in the axe throwing contest. I wasn't able to knock the lumberjack off the log in the log rolling contest. And his nephew is saying, well, you're a turtle. You're not supposed to be able to do all those things. And, Uncle Makish kind of, he wants to feel self-pity. And he goes on and saying, well, you must get tired of all the stories that I tell, that I repeat the stories. And his nephew, Poco the Moose, says, well, I learned something new with every retelling. And eventually, he kind of under, I like that character because he's me in both ways and part of my life. One aspect, at 61 years old, I have nephews and nieces in their 30s. So I'm like Uncle Makish with my younger nephews and nieces. But on the other hand, sometimes I'm also like Poku the Moose because of my mom's siblings. I have some aunts and uncles that are in their 80s, so I understand what it's like to be an older person and how you want to reconnect with that respect in your life. And so he's definitely one of my favorite characters. And because he's long lived, he actually forms like the continuity of the stories all the way from the 1600s up until the early 1900s as the stories progress.
How did you get started with the artwork? It is amazing. Like for your book, I saw it. I went on your website. I'm really excited to read your book, by the way. All that's kind of genre I'm interested in. So, can you tell me a little bit about the art for your book, like the illustrations?
Well, all the artwork was done. I actually had two artists working on the book. One was a storyboard artist named Masami Kiyono, and she is a young woman, an artist out in Manhattan. And one of the things she does is she helps design or storyboard TV commercials. In fact, one of her commercials was on the Super Bowl a couple of years ago. So she designed all the illustration with rough sketches, and we would talk together about what we wanted to see in this scene. And we work together very well. We have a kind of a common vision. I can almost see what she's going to do. And then once we have the rough sketches, Natasha finishes them and she adds her own touches and her own interpretation. So she's not just like filling in the lines, she's using the rough sketches as the inspiration for the final illustrations that she does. And we have to still talk through each of those illustrations and talk about details that are in them. And sometimes we have to revise them. So it's a very time intensive process to actually go through. It's one of the things that makes this book very unique because a lot of times people do a book with an illustrated book, for example, illustrated children's book with 30 illustrations. Well, it's a very easy project to do. But when you're doing a book with 450 illustrations, it's very, very intense, especially as you get closer to the end of the project, because it takes a lot of time. And all those revisions that you have to do on the prior illustrations that you started earlier in the process, all that time that you've lost kind of, it's cumulative, it adds up. And so by the time you're working at the end of the project, you're kind of falling behind a little bit. And it takes a real dedication. So it was a very intense process, and the book is kind of unique structure-wise. It's almost like a graphic novel, but it's not a graphic novel. Graphic novel has like very much a comic book style with thought bubbles. In this book, there's almost an illustration per page. So in that is it's very illustrative intent. So the illustrations tell part of the story, but there's no thought bubbles. No text on these illustrations because they're beautiful, and we didn't want to like squash them or cover them over with, thought bubbles. So it was a very intense process, but you can see the artwork that Natasha did is beautiful, and it has a very three-dimensional palette to it and description.
How long did it take you from start to finish, like with the artwork, with the writing? You said it was very writing intensive. How long did it take to get them from start to finish?
I think this book project itself took 3 years to do these first two volumes. And part of it was because we didn't really know what we were doing at first. I mean, we didn't have a vision of what these books would look like at the end. We wrote one story and then it was like, well, you know what? I think there's another story to tell. And so we wrote the second story in the book series. And then what you realize as you start developing characters, you realize that there's threads and aspects that connect in ways that you only see as you do more and more stories. And when you pull on those threads, other stories pop out and you start asking questions about the characters, like where did they come from? Where did the Shaw come from, the characters come from? So you write other stories. So it was a bigger prop. We didn't really have an idea. And finally, it came out to be 10 stories that we actually wrote. Now we're doing a totally different. We have two other books in the works, and we're doing it a little differently. So we're already decided that we're doing one story per book for the next couple of books. And the next book is going to come out in August, It's going to be called The Dance of Creation, which will be a sequel and a prequel to the story. And Masami has already finished the rough sketches, and Natasha is actually going to start with the final illustrations on the 3rd of June. So we're expecting to probably will have that done by the end of the summer. And the following book after that is going to be called All Around You, There Is a Light. And that book we're working on right now on the rough sketches. And I expect before the end of the year, Natasha will also be working on those final. And we expect to have that book down in probably a year, I think. And both these books are part of the same old grandmother's tree universe, as they say. So it's they're continuation with the same characters and just different stories within that universe. So it's now going to develop into a book series. How long it's going to continue, we'll see. But we definitely have these two books are definitely in works, and I have an idea for at least two other books beyond that. But I really haven't done much besides doing some very rough wordsmithing on some of those ideas and kind of typed out some of the ideas I have for those. But the books are very hard to describe, I think. When I describe them to people, I find that when I say, okay, I wrote a illustrated book of my Quebec and Algonquin ancestors and reimagine Quebec in the 17th and early 20th century. With magical trickster animal characters that can look at me like, what the heck is that? How does that even work? And it turns out when I actually hand copies of this book to people get it right away. And it's, the response people when they get the book has been amazing. It's been a slow process, and we're very kind of slowly getting the word out and grow. I have it available in some bookstores here in New England. I have it in some libraries in New England. It's also for sale at the St. Kateri Shrine in Fonda, New York. And it's also for sale at the St. Kateri Shrine in Quebec, actually, just south of Montreal. So it takes time to get the word out. But everyone who has this book just really loves it and very impressed with it because it's so different from a lot of what is available today. It's an original idea. It's a very positive message, but the book stories don't hit you over the head with their positive message, their morality. It doesn't say, this is the lesson you've got to get out of this book. It's not heavy-handed in that regard. It's very entertaining. Some of the stories are very thoughtful, poignant. Some are very farcical and kind of just funny and humorous, but they're all tied in together, and we've kind of developed this very rich, universe of characters. When I, for example, when I developed the Wikipedia for Old Grandmother's Tree, and I have it on my website, we have, I think, well over 100 different entries in that Wikipedia of characters, places, and objects of the story. So it's actually getting to be a very rich story universe. Ultimately, I really would like to see these books turned into an animated series, like a short animated series. And I think, look, Natasha's artwork has already made it ready-made for that. It really is ready for that. So those are my long-term goals for the book project.
I was just gonna add when you were talking about it, I was like, that would make an amazing animated series. Like I could picture that, especially with your artwork and your story, and it's just magical. Like it's so the way you tell it is it sounds amazing. So what is the process like for you now writing the other books coming on? Like do you have like a certain routine you start off with like with writing? Like some people they get up in the morning, have coffee, start writing. What's your process like?
I really don't have a set routine, and I belong to writers groups. So I spend time talking to other writers, and there is kind of every writer has their own different routine. Some people like to write outlines of their stories and they kind of fill it in. I don't do any of that, and I don't have a set time that I write. I find that the stories kind of marinate within myself and my imagination and back in my very deep part of my subconscious almost. And when they're ready to come out, they just come out. And it could be first thing in the morning. It could be in the middle of the night. If I'm inspired in the middle of the night and I have the story, I can see it in my mind, I'll sit there in front of the computer and I'll type. And when I'm in that kind of creative moment, I'll find that I'll write a story, you know, at least 3,000 words just in one sitting, and have most of the story, at least the bones of it, done in one story. And of course, you know, even though as authors, we always think the first draft is just beautiful and it's perfect, it really isn't. You always have to take time to share with other people to read, and your editor, and you get that advice and you incorporate and you kind of refine it for a little bit. And so that's why I've been working with these books. I've had these ideas, they kind of in the back of my mind, I kind of see it. And I think because I'm a visual person, I see the stories unfold almost like a movie in my mind. And then I write and describe what happens. And the other thing is, the technique I do is that I don't really dictate my characters what they do, is I set the stage, I put them into an environment or a situation, and then I just watch what they do. And then I record that and write that in there. So for some people who write, that may sound very loose and very unstructured, and I would say that it is, but that's what works for me. So every author is going to be different, but that's how I write. I'm not a writer by demand.
Did you imagine that it would, this project, like when you first started the books, would become, take on a life of its own? Like how you started creating a book series, you said you didn't really have a vision. Do you think it would take on the life that it has?
Not initially, no. Because the very first story actually started because I'm learning French. A couple of years ago, I started learning French, and part of my coursework, I wrote a short story in French about my great-great-grandmother in Quebec on her farm, and she has the farm animals sneak out at midnight in the middle of the winter and go tobogganing down the hill, and she comes out and kind of wants to chastise them for being out at night, but instead she just hops on the toboggan and goes down sliding, you know, tobogganing with them. And it was kind of just, oh, it was just kind of funny story. And that's how it kind of began. But like I said, I realized I liked the character, so I said, well, let me just try to tell another story. So I wrote another story featuring primarily the farm animals, you know, kind of talking farm animals with my great-great-grandmother. And that became the beginning of what became Old Grandmother's Tree. The old grandmother, which in this case is Mitio Goku, my Algonquin ancestor, she came in the story because my great-great-grandmother in the first story, Delia Meunier, was wearing a shawl that had the colors of the Northern Lights. And when we added that detail, and we didn't even know why we did, myself and the artist, but we realized that, well, that shawl is magical. Why is it magical? Well, it belonged to her ancestor, Mitio Goku, and it's been passed down from generation to generation. And then the next question we asked was, well, why is the shawl magical? And then the answer was, well, it was given to her by her husband, Pierre Kauk, on their wedding night. And in the middle of the night, Mitio Goku wakes up, goes outside to look at the stars, and she meets the spirit of her first husband who died 5 years earlier in the attack. And he tells her, you know, I'm glad that you're not alone. You know, because she's almost apologetic, I married again. And he's like, no, I'm happy for you. I'm happy that you're not alone. And as a wedding gift, he reaches up to the sky, grabs the Northern Lights, and throws them into the shawl that she was wearing that otherwise was gray and now has the colors of the Northern Lights. And so that shawl gets passed down. And once we had magic into the world, it was very easy to add Native American-inspired trickster characters in there too. And so that they are in themselves generate all kind of stories. So once you kind of create a universe, all kind of stories can start jumping out when you have characters and you know, multiple characters and locations and set your stories over a long period of time, all kind of stories can pop out. So that's kind of like how it started. And so you know, I like I said, I do think that the story has great potential to be an animated series and continue on.
What is out of all of the things that you did, like what is your, do you have a favorite book, like out of the series, like the that you worked on?
Well, I mean, I think that there's only two books right now, so it's really hard to say I have a favorite one. They're both good. I think certainly the very first story of the first book is special to me because the story starts off with Michio Goku's grandparents, and it's 5 years after the attack. And Michio Goku's grandparents are talking about Michio Goku, that she's still a young woman, she's a widow. She doesn't really seem to be interested in anybody except maybe one person, Pierre Kauk, but she doesn't seem interested in getting married and moving on with her life. And it's her grandparents that actually kind of get in the story, get it started. And they finally grab the grandfather, goes to a church, he prays for Michio Goku at first, and then he goes to the village and grabs Pierre Kauk and Michio Goku, literally grabs him by the hand and says, "I know that you love each other." And he gets each of them to admit that they love the other one, and finally to go ahead and commit to marry. And I think I really love that story because it's about, I love the story of a grandfather praying for his grandchildren. I love the story. I love the aspect of the story of over not wallowing in the tragedies of our life, but moving on and building something beautiful in the next thing that happens for our lives. And so I think that was probably the most important one. And there's a lot going on in that story and in the story that follows it, which is actually the wedding story of the wedding between Pierre Kauk and Michio Goku. In the first two stories, for example, what's going on? Well, we have people in the village recovering even 5 years later from the attack, the effects of having the village attacked. You've got an aspect of time travel where the grandfather is actually pulled forward to 1902 and he sees one of his descendants through Michio Goku. He doesn't understand what's going on, but he's pulled briefly forward in time and then pulled back by the trickster animal characters. And of course, we have a ghost, the ghost of Asababish, Michio Goku's first husband visits there. Plus lots of magic and trickster animal characters. So it's a very busy first part of the book. But I think within those two stories certainly is, I think, all the elements of what is to come as you read through the rest of the series.
What was the hardest part for you, like writing the books?
Think it was investing the time and money to do it is the hardest part. I think that a lot of people get the idea, well, I'm just going to write a book, I'll be able to self-publish it. And I don't think they realize just how much work it takes to make it happen. And to really do it right, you have to invest the time and you have to invest a lot of time. And also to do it right, you have to spend some money. I spent money on editorial services, so I had all the grammar right, so I had people, writers coach, look at what I was writing and provide advice and feedback. The artwork itself, that also took an investment also, so time. So if you're going to do a book, you have to understand you're going to have to put the time in and you're going to have to do the money. And you're also going to have to set your expectation. You're going to realize that it's going to take time for the word about your book to get out. And even doing that, you have to be active. I go to libraries. I go to bookstores. I'm appearing on multiple podcasts in the United States and Canada to talk about the books. So you really have to put the effort in. You can't just kind of, throw something together, pay a couple hundred bucks for an artist to design a cover for you, put it on Amazon KDP, and voila, you have a bestseller. It just doesn't happen that way. You have, unless that's all you want. If you just want to claim that you did a book, then maybe that's okay. But if you really want something successful, you have to invest the time and the money.
Well, I want to thank you for coming on today. I've really enjoyed our interview. And can you tell everybody, are you able to buy your book like online? My audience.
Absolutely, absolutely. The books are available on Amazon. And the best way to start You can go to my website, which is oldgrandmotherstree.com, oldgrandmotherstree.com, and in there you'll find links to buy the books in either French or English, of course, English and French. You'll find the Wikipedia. You have links to some of the podcasts been on, my biography, the biography of Natasha, the artist, and that's where you can buy the books. The books are available on Amazon.
All right, well, I want to thank you for coming on today and letting me interview you. I've enjoyed it. I hope you have a great day. Thank you.
Thank you.